ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, Selena Green here again with you today. Now, in just a sec, we'll have a discussion about changes to the state's Mining Act that has farmers concerned about the future. And if it's something you'd like to share your thoughts on, are you concerned what these changes mean for your land? Let me know on my talkback number. It's 1300 160 222 or text me on 0467 922 783. You'll find out more about what these actual changes are in just a moment. And also today, have you heard of mesquite? It's considered one of the worst pest plants we have spreading across Australia. You'll meet a man known as the King of Mesquite. He has a striking resemblance to a king of another kind, who's been called in to help deal with it in a part of the country that's overrun.
No, it's real bad, especially in this area. This is the most mesquite I've seen around the country. It's all around here. They've got a bad infestation here.
You'll learn more about the methods that he's deploying against mesquite very soon. But first today, it's promised, changes to the Mining Act have been passed in State Parliament, which effectively mean that mining companies now have the ability to extend exploration tenures beyond the current 18-year time limit. It's been met with some pushback from farmers who worry it creates uncertainty and risks productive farmland being locked in for mining for decades to come. Grain Producers SA has condemned the government's decision to push the changes through. Brad Perry, the CEO of Grain Producers SA, joins me. Brad, welcome back again to the Country Hour.
G'day, Selena.
What are the key concerns that Grain Producers has about the changes that have gone through Parliament this week?
When we were initially briefed by the Department for Mining, it was some months ago now, and the reason that they gave for reviewing the Mining Act was about streamlining with the Hydrogen Renewable Energy Act, and we had a number of concerns about that act as well, and land access rights for grain producers and other farmers. And so the mining process, the mining process has gone through for the act, and now we see a bill that's gone into Parliament. It's actually passed the House of Assembly, where they're proposing for the current 18-year exploration tenure to be extended in 5-year allotments. So I think the big concern for us is that it creates a lot of uncertainty for those farmers who have got exploration agreements on their land. There's no fixed end date for those, and you can't invest and you can't plan for the future if you've got that uncertainty.
Listen, you've previously written to the government opposing tenure extensions, but was this something you were expected to get through these changes this week, or is this taking you a bit by surprise?
No, certainly it's taken us by surprise. We weren't briefed or consulted on the final draft bill, so it did certainly take us by surprise. We were spoken to by Fraser Ellis, who's a member for Narunga, about some amendments that he wanted to put forward, but again, that was very last minute as well. And so really we're now saying, well, look, hold up, let's actually get a brief. We as the peak body for grain producers need a brief to understand exactly what's being proposed here. And from my discussions, I think the opposition in the Legislative Council is going to reserve the right to do some more briefing on what it might mean for the impact on primary producers. But we just can't see this further uncertainty. We've got a lot of mining projects and other projects in the pipeline, and we need to really be backing our farmers and giving them the confidence to, whether it continue on their property, whether it's succession planning or investing in the future, expanding, all of these things are just creating unnecessary uncertainty.
We're going to hear from the Minister on this shortly, but he says this doesn't create any more uncertainty because if a licence expires under the 18 years, someone else can come in and bid to mine that land. So it doesn't, in his words, extinguish or remove that land from the Act. So others can come in and bid to mine that land after 18 years. So what's the difference now if it's an extension as compared to a new bid for a lease?
Well, it gives a clear end goal. So we've got, we don't want to see any more risk of land banking. you know, where those exploration licences will sit idle for years and years. So under this, you've got the 18 years, but then they can be granted new exploration licences for five-year allotments, and it doesn't appear like there's an end date on that either. So, again, farmers needing to plan ahead need certainty. That's why we've always said our position is that let's stick with that end date so they know when that exploration license will end. If someone wants to, if a mining company or others want to come in and apply to extend it, then you know that starts everything again, and that'll be up for discussion. I guess the big thing for us when we were talking about a review of this act was making it more concise with streamlined with the Hydrogen Renewable Energy Act is the access to farmland through a special license that's in the HRE Act. We certainly didn't want to see that that extended into any other act. So that's something that we'll be keeping an eye on.
Yeah, in the submission to your government, you did ask for other protections not included. What were they? What hasn't been included in these changes that you would have liked to have seen?
Yeah, we certainly did. So in our submission, we asked to increase the notice period for mining companies from 42 days to 90. We also want to establish a voluntary mediation service to help help these farmers and landowners in disputes with exploration companies. And the other probably big thing was we called for the removing of the outdated $2,500 cap on reimbursable legal advice and ensure full rehab bonds are held to protect farmland. So really we're just looking to get a few things back in the farmers' favour when it comes to right, so we know we need to have, and the bottom line is we know we need to have a strong agricultural industry, we need to have a strong mining industry, we do think they can coexist, but we've got to also have land access and rights for farmers ahead of those other companies, in our view.
Do you think those things that you're still fighting for, are they off the table now, or is this something you think could still be in the mix?
Oh, I think at this stage they've been ignored in the draft bill that's been put forward, so I can't see that they would be included at any stage, but we'll be working with those parties when we get a briefing to see if there's any changes that can be still made in the Legislative Council before it goes through.
Brad Perry, thanks for joining us on the Country Hour again.
Thanks, Lena.
Brad Perry there, CEO of Grain Producers South Australia. Todd Woodward is a farmer at Ratanbully and the chair of the Limestone Coast Sustainable Futures Association. Well, he told Sam Bradbrook he feels the changes create a lot of uncertainty.
Having this sitting over you for years and years and years and years is, you know, severely impacting communities' mental health, I believe. It's the way that the minister has a lot more discretion over the time and the renewal of these leases over these tenements that that the mining companies, you know, have exploration rights over.
Are you concerned that, you know, you might be told, okay, there's a 10 or 15 year lease over the land, but then you could get to the end of that time and find out it's been, you know, extended? Is that sort of what you and the group are worried about?
That's correct, yeah. Without being 100% specific, it is just creating this this certainty for the mining community. We have real reservations around the mining Department of Mines being the administered the handing out of mining licences and also regulating what happens on these leases and licence areas. We think there's a huge conflict of interest there, and part of our group submission to this issues paper when it came up to us earlier in the year was, you know, one of our main points was to create a position, being an ombudsman or a commissioner that can sit there and be an independent, you know, adjudicator in any conflict between landholders and miners.
That is the chair of the Limestone Coast Sustainable Futures Association, Todd Woodward, there speaking with Sam Bradbrook. Well, Sam also spoke with the Minister for Energy and Mining, Tom Koutsantonis, and asked him to explain exactly what has been changed.
So we've made a couple of changes. The most important one is if there's a change of control in a mining company, and that is that they want to sell their exploration lease or sell their mining tenement, the South Australian government can do its due diligence about whether or not the people who are buying this actually have the capabilities to fulfil the requirements that are in the legislation and in the agreements that they have. Often a lot of farmers complain about people who've got exploration tenements over their land someone pegs a tenement and they sell it to someone else and they sell it again, and it keeps them going through these cycles of sales, and the state government has no real say in who owns it. And we want to make sure there's a basic capability in place so we can make sure we get appropriate people who are having interface with people who own freehold land. The other part of it is allowing an extension beyond 18 years of having an exploration license. Currently, once you peg a tenement on land, you only have 18 years to develop it into a mine. Now, I think that's enough. 18 years is a good hard deadline, but there might be some extenuating circumstances that might require or, you know, be benefited by an extension. So what the legislation is doing is giving the minister full discretion to either give or not give an extension, and that can be based on a number of criteria. It could be based on, you know, commodity prices have been low, so the mine's been uneconomic, and therefore that's why they haven't been able to do it, or they haven't been able to get access to land because of disputes or court action, so that they deserve an extension. But most of the time they won't be granted an extension because I believe 18 years is enough. They're the main changes.
Speaking to some local farmers, particularly that are affected at the moment by the AR3 rare earths exploration, they say that the changes create more uncertainty for them, given that there could be an extension at the end of that exploration license. What do you say to those concerns?
Well, they're wrong for a couple of reasons. The first reason that they're wrong is if the exploration license expires, all that means is someone else can bid at the end of that 18 years to explore again. So it doesn't extinguish the land from the Mining Act. It's still part, still can be explored by other people who make applications. So it's, they're not right about that at all. And that argument didn't work. And I was very pleased last night because the Liberal Party gave us unanimous support on these changes. And, you know, they claim they represent regional communities. So they're the ones who also realise this doesn't extinguish exploration rights on farmland. It's just one proponent has 18 years. Once that 18 years is up, someone else can go in and explore for 18 years. So it doesn't change that at all.
These changes take a long time to formulate, but rare earths in particular and critical minerals have been in the news a lot lately, particularly as part of Australia and the US's relationship. Were these changes brought on by this, I guess, new push and new need for critical mineral exploration?
No, well, the reason I brought these changes in is there are a number of exploration tenements coming to the end of their life, and there's one or two where you could make an argument that the proponents are being treated harshly. That is, through no fault of their own, they've been able to get access to land because they've got dispute with native title holders, or there's environmental court action against them, and they haven't been able to fulfill their requirements, so they can't actually get out there and explore. But there's a relatively good deposit that is worth thinking about developing into a mine. So it's more about making sure that we have the ability to create wealth and create jobs in the state, to make sure that people who are taking risks in South Australia by investing in the mining industry are also backed by the government. But it's also giving the discretion for us to say, no, you've had 18 years, that's enough, time to move on.
One option put forward by the farmers here in the southeast was an independent commissioner to oversee compliance with mining leases and make that independent from the Department for Energy and Mining that hands out the mining leases. I guess, what do you think about splitting those two roles away from the Department for Energy and Mining?
Well, that would be a terrible mistake, and no one supports that. I think none of the two major parties. That amendment was moved and talked about by Mr. Fraser Ellis, who's an independent in the York Peninsula. The Liberal Party and Labor Party voted to remove that for a very good reason. You have an independent ombudsman who issues tenements and inspects them for compliance. The public will have no influence whatsoever over the regulatory framework. And if it's done independently, no pressure can be brought to bear on politicians. Politicians are elected each and every 4 years. They're required to answer to the parliament. Independent statutory officers give an annual report once a year. They never meet with the public. They don't get cross-examined by public representatives. You would have less of a say and less influence on policy than you do now. this would be a really retrograde step for farmers. If you want to have a say, at the very least, on mining policy, you get to vote. If you hand this power to an unelected official, there will be absolutely no influence the public will have on whether tenements are granted or whether compliance is enforced or not, because that person will be answerable to no one.
That's the Minister for Energy and Mining, Tom Koutsantonis, speaking there to Sam Bradbrook. It's just going on 20 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour. You're with Selena Green today. And a bit of breaking news that's just coming through now is that the Liberal Shadow Ministry has agreed to dump its net zero by 2050 policy from the party's platform. The Shadow Ministry has agreed, we're told, to scrap net zero from the Climate Change Act and repeal Labor's 2030 emissions reduction target. This follows the National Party making a similar decision in recent weeks. So dumping of the net zero platform by the Liberal Shadow Ministry. That news just breaking, and there'll be more to come on your ABC throughout the rest of the day.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, have you ever heard of mesquite? It's a spiny shrub, or tree, native to the Americas, but here in Australia it's considered one of the worst weeds that we can have spreading due to its ability to form dense, impenetrable thickets. Our graziers in the far west of New South Wales are fighting an ongoing battle against an infestation of this pest, and so they've called in someone dubbed the King of Mesquite. For the past decade, contractor Mark Facer and his family have been in New South Wales tackling weeds, but especially mesquite.
Yeah, we travel all over New South Wales and all over Queensland. We've been doing different sorts of weeds control, but yes. So, yeah, wherever the weeds are, that's where we go.
And how would you describe the overall mesquite problem in our country at the moment?
Very big, big time. It's real bad, especially in this area. This is the most mesquite I've seen around the country. It's all around here. They've got a bad infestation here.
And tell me about the method that you've kind of developed and what you think is the only solution for eradicating it.
Well, I think it's the only solution for most weeds. We used to spray it, and I got over the spraying because we weren't killing it. We were coming back and doing the bushes again next year or the year after, and next time it'd probably be worse. So I went into brush cutters, and I thought there must be another way to do this. I fiddled around, and because I make my own axes and everything, so I made up a thing to go on the brush cutters so as we could cut and poison at the same time to cut the plant down ground level so as you can still drive over it. You know, if you're driving through the country, that the stumps are not going to, you know, you're not going to have big stumps everywhere. We cut it off ground level and poison it. By doing it like that, the chemical is going straight into the sap flow, straight through to the roots, and the rest of it just fades away after a couple of years, 12 months, 2 years, and it's gone, you know, so... Yeah, but we find that this is the only way. Whatever we cut, whatever we poison, there's 100% kill. You know, you're going to get seed, but when we do cut them off and we do poison the stump, we do spray the seed that's around the drip line. It'll knock 99% of them anyway. You might get the odd seed back. That's pretty rare too. But you follow it up every 12, you know, like after 12 months, and you should eradicate the problem in that area that you've done.
Contractor Mark Facer. He was speaking at a workshop on managing cactus and mesquite in the far west, where he was taken aback by the scale of the infestation. On One Tree Station north of Broken Hill, Sam and Tennille Seema believe there's millions of trees on their property.
So the Seemers bought One Tree back in 1969, and mesquite was already prevalent on the station. Rumour goes that previous owners had come across some seeds through friends that worked on the rejuvenation of mines here in Broken Hill. And at that time, mesquite was thought to be a great plant to hold together the country. So they got hold of some seeds and were casting them around the house and house tank and roads and paddock. At the time, mesquite that germinated from those seeds, the thorn had been bred out, so it was perfect for regeneration. However, once it really took hold of the country and started germinating, it went back to its natural state and the thorns were there once more.
So when was this, or when did you start to notice or get concerned about mesquite?
Yeah, so this all happened in the late 40s and 50s. Seamers bought it in 69. They started spraying in the early 1970s. And then with each good year that occurred from then on, in the early 70s, early to mid-70s, around 2000, there was a bit of an explosion with a good year. We really noticed it in 2010-11, and then it was followed up in 2016 with a good year, and then it's been a snowball effect ever since.
How have you been managing it or trying to manage it?
We've been spraying every year or most years. It's definitely something that's in our budget and we put money towards annually. We've taken opportunities to apply for a few grants that have been up for grabs, and we have been successful there. It's been pretty tricky. There is definitely an epicentre to the infestation, and we have been working on the management strategy, I guess, of working in towards the epicentre. So getting all of the plants that are outlying and scattered through the station, and then working our way in to a paddock called Scott's Paddock. Yeah, it has been a lot of work, a big expense.
And can you give me a sense of how many plants or the acreage or hectares that are covered?
Yeah, look, that's a bit of a tricky one. The bulk of the infestation is probably on one tree, which one tree itself is around 100,000 acres. Now, when I say 100,000 acres, it doesn't mean that whole 100,000 acres is littered with plants, but there is, you know, there's probably 10 or 15,000 acres, which is quite solid. Apart from that, they're just quite sporadic how it's spread through paddocks, how it's been carried, deposited, and, you know, has taken off in certain areas. But the plant numbers are, in their millions, which is pretty hard. I'm sure it'd be hard for your listeners to imagine without actually eyeballing it and seeing it. It is quite a, to see the infestations, a bit of an eye-opener.
We are spraying at least 20,000 to 30,000 plants a year. That's outside of projects that are happening, so that probably gives you some indication of the number of plants that are there.
That's Sam and Tennille Seamer from One Tree Station, north of Broken Hill, speaking to Catherine Spackman. So, yeah, millions of mesquite trees that they are trying to combat. If you want to read more about this and see some photos from the workshop with the King of Mesquite and a bit of an idea of the spread of the trees on that property, you can head to abc.net.au/rural. Right now, it's 27 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green. Let's head to the Weather Bureau and another hello today to Mark Analak. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena. How are you going?
Very good. And it was a very fresh start for some parts yesterday. Was it, again, a cold morning today?
Not particularly, no. Look, we had got a northerly wind sort of developing across the state. It's still very dry atmosphere, but temperatures have been up quite significantly this morning compared to yesterday. You know, Port Augusta got down to a minimum of 16 degrees, of all things, so very different to the day before. There were a couple of places in the southeast that still got down to the low single figures, Narracourt 2, Padthaway 3, but as a general rule, temperatures were fairly significantly warmer this morning, mainly owing to a large amount of high cloud that's sort of drifting across our state, emanating from thunderstorms that occurred over WA yesterday. So looking at the satellite picture now, we still have quite an extensive area of high cloud drifting across South Australia, particularly through sort of central and eastern parts. Within that band, there are some showers showing up on the WeatherWatch radar, but rainfall totals have been fairly light on. I think up to 9 o'clock this morning, we had 4 millimetres at Nullarbor. Across Eyre Peninsula, rainfall totals were less than a millimetre. And since 9 o'clock, we've got this band moving through the mid-north, and that's produced up to a couple of millimetres here and there. But as I said, it's a very dry atmosphere. So while the WeatherWatch radar looks quite impressive, a lot of that is actually evaporating before it hits the ground, and rainfall totals at the surface are fairly light on. I expect that cloud to continue to drift eastwards today, and this evening we'll see those showers continue to move across the east again. Not expecting a huge amount of rainfall from it. But in the west, where the skies are clear, we're going to see some afternoon showers and thunderstorms develop in association with a low pressure system that's over Western South Australia. That low pressure system will drag those showers and thunderstorms further east overnight tonight, covering central districts and eastern districts during tomorrow, before it finally clears away to the through east of our border tomorrow night. But in behind it, we're likely to see some more showers and thunderstorms developing about the far north-northwest tomorrow afternoon and evening. Further south tomorrow, once that band moves through, we'll be in a broad south, sort of a west to southwesterly flow, so cooler conditions are forecast. And even into the weekend, we'll see a ridge of high pressure building across the northern parts of the state, maintaining that cooler southwesterly flow over agricultural areas. What that means is we're likely to see some onshore flow bringing isolated showers to southern agricultural areas through the weekend. A couple of cold fronts embedded in that southwesterly flow will see an increase in shower activity about agricultural areas, mainly sort of southern coastal fringes, but we could see some light showers pushing into the northern agricultural area with those fronts passing by. The first of which looks like it'll come through Sunday afternoon. It's probably our best chance of picking up some showers across agricultural areas with that first cold front. And then as we move into the early part of next week, we maintain that cooler southwesterly flow, so maximum temperatures remaining below average, with showers pushing up from the, over southern parts of the state right through the early part of next week. In terms of rainfall totals between now and the end of Monday, generally less than 2 millimetres, increasing to 2 to 15 millimetres about the southern agricultural area and across the far north of the state with those thunderstorms. We could also see sort of isolated falls of 10 to 30 millimetres about southern coastal fringes and the southern Mount Lofty ranges, depending on those cold fronts as they come through. But thunderstorms in the far northwest may also deliver a little bit more rainfall as well. So on the whole, agricultural areas probably looking at 2 to 15 millimetres with some isolated falls of 10 to 30 millimetres about those southern coasts and southern Mount Lofty ranges, Selena.
Thanks for that, Mark. Mark Analak, our senior forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. So let's have a look at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow. Partly cloudy in the upper western district with a medium chance of showers in the northeast, a slight chance elsewhere, and there's a chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and into the evening. For the lower western district, mostly sunny with a slight chance of a shower. There's a chance of a thunderstorm in the late afternoon and evening as well. Overnight temperatures falling between 12 and 16 degrees. During the day, they should reach the low to mid-30s. It is 28 minutes to one.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, coming up in this next half an hour, blindsided, a slap in the face. Those are some of the words used to describe how irrigators are felt by yesterday's announcement here in South Australia of a new round of voluntary buybacks in the southern Murray-Darling Basin. You'll hear more about their thoughts on that. And how safe are Australian blueberries to eat now that there has been a decision made to stop the use of a common pesticide in the berry industry? You'll hear about that as well. If you want to join me at any time throughout the half an hour, perhaps you've got some thoughts on anything you hear, or maybe you've been ruminating over these changes to the Mining Act here in South Australia and what they might mean for you. My talkback number is 1300 160 222. The text line is 0467 922783. That's all to come after we get some news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the Renmark Irrigation Trust says it was blindsided by the announcement of a new round of voluntary water buybacks. Federal Water Minister Murray Watt made the announcement at the Basin Leaders Summit in Adelaide yesterday, increasing the volume of water that may be purchased by 130 gigalitres. Chief Executive Rosalie Oricht says it's not clear what the potential impact will be of taking water out of the region. A group of farmers in South Australia's southeast says changes to the state's Mining Act will increase uncertainty for landholders subject to mining leases. The changes passed in Parliament this week give the mining minister power to extend an 18-year lease if deemed suitable. Another change gives the minister power to decide whether the sale of a lease between two companies is appropriate. And housing advocates have criticised the South Australian government and the opposition, who voted down a bill which would have improved minimum standards for renters. The bill was introduced used by the Greens' Robert Sims and would have forced landlords to ensure their rental properties had adequate heating and cooling, insulation, ventilation and more efficient appliances. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, throughout the drought, Rural Aid has been one of the main charities rolling out assistance to farmers across South Australia. Maybe you've reached out to them for some support. We've spoken to them a lot about how significant that demand has been over the last year or so. Well, now we've reached harvest time for 2025 and nearing the end of the year, has that demand waned at all? Rural Aid CEO is Mr. John Walters. He joins me. Good afternoon, John. Thanks for joining me on the Country Hour.
Oh, thanks so much, Selena. Really appreciate the chance to have a chat and just talk about all things rural.
It's been a while since we checked in. We know that Rural Aid has had some very high demand here in South Australia during this drought. Has that changed at all since we last spoke?
Oh, look, and it's a great question. And South Australia has been so much in the thoughts of so many people, and particularly here at Rural Aid. And it's not just this last 12 months. We're really talking 18 months of 2 years of just consistent ongoing support into the state and into those farming families, and just conscious that while we've seen a little bit of rain last month in particular, as a whole, people are still very, very conscious of the tight circumstances they have in front of them. They're still very carefully managing their finances. They're just making a cautious approach to everything that they do, obviously with trying to be as optimistic as they can. And from our perspective, we've seen a little bit of a slowing of the demand for hay, financial assistance, and some of that emergency household drinking water that we delivered throughout the really peak period. But underlying everything, I think, is that wariness, and that's translating into to people just also wanting to really stay connected to our mental health and wellbeing specialist who's based in Corn. She's been incredibly busy.
And that, I guess, gives a reminder of a bit of the breadth of services that Rural Aid does provide. It is, there are those variation in services that people are reaching out for and assistance that people are asking of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, the demand for hay is certainly tailed off from what it was 3, 4, 5 months ago, where it was really high request rates flowing through, and we're just so pleased that that's the case, that there has been a little bit of a break, that we've seen again some rain, and with that rain we've seen crops get through to that all important stage. We've seen the pastures turn around, people who've had stock in confinement areas been released back out into the paddock. And so we've just seen the screws loosen a little, but by no means are people completely out of the woods. And I think we're even seeing our the government in South Australia say words to that effect as well. So, and that's really reflected in the demand for support coming from Rural Aid.
So given all of that demand, how has Rural Aid sort of been keeping up with that demand? And I guess in terms of the financial capabilities that you have, the staff capabilities, sort of where are things at for you at the moment?
I think this is always a bit of the challenge for an organisation like Rural Aid, because 99% of what we do is off the back of donations from mums and dads and businesses, big and small, and community organisations and the like. And it's those donations that allow us to buy that hay, to buy that emergency household drinking water, to have counsellors employed in our teams to do the work that they do. And when the problem is very, very visible and is very much in the headlines, I think it's one of the great strengths of Australians, is they want to rally around that and they want to be a part of the solution. And thankfully, they've typically picked Rural Aid as one of the vehicles to provide that help and support. But when things move out of the headlines, but the underlying problem remains, then we see a tailing off in the donations and the support that comes our way. But we know the demand is still quite high, and we know that people need this long-term support to be able to help them get through and back to where they need. And so we're saying to people, well, you know what? Christmas is a time of giving. So if you're thinking about giving, whether that's directly to a family member, or you want to give a little bit more broadly, then maybe think about our farmers, the importance that they play every day, and then think of organisations like Rural Aid and how we in turn can make sure that our farming families get what they need during a challenging set of circumstances that they're still experiencing. My big wish for 2026 is that we get the break, and it's a break that is very widespread and gets people going again and gives them the opportunity to put some dollars back in the bank. Like, people invest very heavily in getting a crop in the ground and relying on getting that through to harvest to be able to put some money back into their businesses. And if you're in the livestock game, again, we know that you can't just flick a switch and suddenly have another bunch of lambs on the ground or calves on the ground to quickly put through a system. Again, it really takes time, and that's why we say recovery just doesn't happen overnight.
John, great to have you on the Country Hour. Thanks so much for your time.
Good on you. Thanks so much.
John Walters there. He's the CEO of Rural Aid, one of the key charities that has been providing support across South Australia during the drought. Well, speaking of the support that has been or is available, Mind Australia received funding earlier this year for a free program tailored towards anyone whose mental health and wellbeing has been impacted by the ongoing drought, not just those who farm. Well, Senior Service Manager Catherine Cousins says the programs engage local practitioners who have an intimate understanding of all the ways a drought can impact a community.
Really, we're looking to support people's mental health, build some resilience and provide that support through these challenging times. So the service is incredibly flexible. Our team members are experienced counsellors and we are providing really flexible support, so we can meet people at their homes or their properties, we can meet somewhere in the community, or also basing ourselves out of community centres and medical centres as well. So the support is really flexible for what people are needing, and we are able to provide that in person, over the phone or via telehealth, so however people are comfortable to access the service.
So is it you can get free ongoing sessions, or is it just more of a short-term thing?
So we provide ongoing support. So there's not a set structure to how people can access the service. So we're operating until the end of June next year. So if people need support weekly up until the end of June next year, then we're able to provide it in that way.
And is it something that people need to be having symptoms of mental illness, or is it they might need to talk to someone?
It's a mental health support program, but there's not a set criteria. So people can access the service if they really just want to talk to someone. It can be once off or it can be ongoing. There's not a set eligibility criteria. It's really just if people have been impacted by the drought or living in that area and they want to have some type of mental health support, then we are here to provide that.
So had Mind been hearing or working with people affected by the drought much before this program started? Like, have you seen numbers increasing in that demographic?
Yeah, we have seen an increase. Mind have been in these regional communities for quite some time, but this is the new funding to provide mental health support. It's more open to the community than our other services are. So, it started in July this year, and we've been seeing a slow increase in the knowledge that it exists and also the uptake in accessing the service. But we do have capacity to support more people, definitely.
People in regional areas, and especially farmers, I would say, are somewhat notorious for not always seeking help when they need it, whether that be physical or mental assistance. Mental health and well-being is something that has definitely been discussed more, not just amid the drought, but in the last 5-10 years. Are more farmers and regional people seeking help these days?
Yeah, it is definitely something that we're seeing, and we know that it's not easy to seek support or ask for help. People who live in regional communities, farmers are very resilient and don't often speak up when they might be having a challenging time. So we want to really break down the barriers to that. And it was also really important to us that we put people in these positions that were in these communities, had existing relationships and knew the experience of the communities that they're working in. So we're really hoping that breaks down some of those barriers for people that might be a bit hesitant for reaching out for some support, because the people that they'll be supported by know their experience because they're a part of the community as well.
Catherine Cousins there, Senior Service Manager for Community Services SA at Mind Australia. She was speaking there to Isabella Kelly. If you'd like to access this service, you can call Mind Connect on 1300 286 463, or if you just search for Mind Australia Drought Mental Health Support.
What's complex, brilliant, and has more than 200 years of rollicking backstory? Our Australian electoral system. Join me to investigate.
Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty. Stream all the episodes on ABC iView.
text that's come through in regards to changes to the Mining Act. This one's from Noel. Hello, Noel. He says, if Minister Koutsantonis is correct, then the Ombudsman for Telecommunication and ICAC, etc., are a waste of space. Alternatively, a mining ombudsman is logical, says Noel. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Keep coming.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, agriculture industry and irrigator bodies say they're shocked by the government's announcement of a new round of voluntary water buybacks in the southern Murray-Darling Basin. The announcement includes increasing the volume of water that may be purchased to 130 gigalitres, bringing the total of all purchase programs to 300 gigalitres. The new buybacks will be drawn from existing expressions of interest rather than new rounds. The Federal Ag Minister Murray Watt made the announcement at the Basin Leaders Summit in Adelaide yesterday. Chief Executive of the Renmark Irrigation Trust, Rosalie Arkwright, was at the summit. She says attendees felt blindsided.
I have to say I felt extremely deflated. It was like the oxygen. We were at the Basin Leadership Summit in Adelaide, and it was like the oxygen got sucked out of the room for half of the stakeholders. Very disappointing that it was announced at that event when we were all being positive and trying to find a way forward for rivers for generations.
So why was that, Rosalie? Why did you feel like the oxygen was sucked out of the room when the announcement came out?
Well, we had just heard that unless the constraints are addressed, no matter how much water we have, we cannot get it onto many parts of the floodplains. And so it's more complex than just adding water. I guess we, as an irrigation community, we were, and supporting our irrigation communities, we were just wanting an opportunity to say, let's go beyond politics and look at what really needs to be done to get the maximum use out of that environmental water.
There seems to be a big focus on, you know, the numbers of this. So, you know, the 450 gigalitre target, which has been part of the basin plan for many, many years. Is there a rush or a concerted effort here to get to that point, maybe at the detriment of irrigators and the environment too?
I believe so. It is a political rush. This was an opportunity to just take a step back and say, what outcomes are we actually achieving? Now, that room with over 200 leaders from around the basin, that room heard that native fish outcomes are still poor, that floodplains where we can't get water to are deteriorating. We heard a range of things like that. And it was really disappointing to then just say, oh, by the way, we're going to take more water out of these communities. One of the things that the minister did acknowledge in the conference was that the Sustainable Communities funding, which is meant to help communities be compensated and address the loss of GDP or the domestic product from irrigation industries, is not effective, it's not sufficient, it's not targeting what needs to be done. We were very concerned about that in South Australia. We said, please do not use this money for putting in new public toilets in main streets. We have to create jobs with that if water comes out of our community.
So let's have a look at the announcement that was made and how that could affect the Riverland. So the plan that the Federal Minister for Water, Murray Watt, announced was that to take another 150 gigalitres of water entitlements from basin communities to push further towards that 450 gigalitre mark in the Murray-Darling Basin plan. If that water was to come out, what does that practically mean for our region?
We don't know, and that is part of the problem. We have been talking to the Commonwealth about this for some time, and our state government has been too. They're hiding behind the water market rules and secrecy of that, and we do not know what impact it will have. We do know that this round will include people who are in intensive irrigation network areas like the trusts in the Riverland, but we do not know what that will be. Our state people told us that probably the first we'll know as trust managers is when we have to approve the transfer of that water off of our water licence. How are we meant to adjust? Now, the Commonwealth has had all of this feedback. These issues have not been addressed. And I guess that's why we were so disappointed with the Minister's announcement at that forum, which was a positive, forward-looking forum for leaders across the basin. By the afternoon, it felt like a lot of farming entities just said, I don't want to engage with this anymore, which I thought was really sad because the MDBA has done a very, very good job in bringing communities along with them. And it was a real, it felt like a slap in the face.
Mm. But do we know if any Riverland irrigators or even RIT for that matter have put out a forward bid to have their water bought for as part of the buybacks?
We have not been advised by the Commonwealth of that. Now, you know, that may be good and it may be bad, but it would be nice to know because as we have our local irrigators who are board members on our boards, they manage these areas. If we don't know what's going to happen, how can you plan for it? And what can we do to address it? Now, we can advocate, we can push these messages through to the government, but until we know for certain what's going on, we can't really plan for it. What we do know is that this, I believe it's another 130 gigalitres, which will take it up to 300 of the 450 being recovered. We do know that it again includes large parcels, generally held by investment companies, parcels of over 20 gigalitres. That is concerning also for our Riverland because these are the parcels of water that provide long-term leasing water security. So if the investors are pushing that along, selling that to the Commonwealth, there will be less water available for leasing in the irrigation community.
That was Rosalie Ahrigt there. She is the Chief Executive of the Renmark Irrigation Trust, and she was speaking with Matt Stevens. And the ABC did reach out to Murray Watt, who I incorrectly identified as the Minister for Ag. He hasn't been for some time. He's instead the Federal Minister for Water. And we have reached out to him for comment. It is 9:09 here on the Country Hour. You're with Selena Green. Well, yesterday, if you were listening in, we heard how Australia's farm chemical regulator has suspended the use of a popular insecticide on several types of berries after rising consumption levels reduced safety margins. The Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, it's now halted the use of dimethoate, a chemical used to control fruit fly on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. The APVMA's chief executive, Scott Hansen, says the move has, and I quote, rebuilt the safety buffer and Australian can continue to enjoy their berries safely.
Data that we were provided with in February this year demonstrated a significant change in the consumption patterns for blueberries, blackberries and raspberries over the last 10 years since the last time we did these calculations for products that are used on those foods. Mm. When we had a look at the increases, it triggered us to do a proactive review of all chemical products that are used on those food crops to work out if we put that calculation of that many times a person is consuming it into our calculators, did we still have a safety margin between levels of exposure and risk levels? And for blueberries, blackberries and raspberries with the chemical dimethoate, we had significantly eaten into that safety buffer and we therefore had to take actions to adjust something on the way in which the product was being used to be able to reinsert a safety margin between exposure levels and what's a risk to a consumer.
So this decision, does it mean that growers basically cannot use dimethoate on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries from now?
Yeah, so our decision to suspend the 11 products, dimethoate products that are used on berries, means that it's illegal to use those products in accordance with what's on their labels at the moment. What's on the labels at the moment says there's a one-day withholding period, for example, for blueberries, between when the product is applied to the blueberries to the time in which the blueberries are harvested. Now, that use pattern, the ability to do that is suspended. And what we have done is issued a permit that allows for those suspended products to still be able to be used for all the remaining uses that are on their labels, because there's a wide range of crops that are still well within safety levels on those products' labels, and allows for it to still be used for blackberries, blueberries and raspberries, but with a withholding period, or a period between when it's treated and when it can be harvested, of now 14 days, because the science and the data shows us that at the 14-day mark post-treatment, we have that lower level of remaining residues. The current consumption patterns pose no risk to consumers.
The peak body, Berries Australia, says it accepts the APVMA's decision, but they say that the 14-day withholding period is unworkable just due to berries being picked so often, you know, 2 to 3 days. So essentially this takes it off the table for the majority of growers. What are your thoughts on that?
So we have a very clear mandate that our responsibility is ensuring that the product remains safe for both consumers, for workers, for the environment, and for our trade. And in running our statutory test, you know, we don't look at and don't take into account any inconvenience or disruption to production systems. And it's not one of the things that we can take into account when we're running those statutory tests as to whether we can approve a product. You know, first and foremost for us is the protection and the safety and health of people and the environment, animals and our trade.
Berries safe for people to consume?
Definitely. The work that we have done indicated that with a significant increase in consumption of berries, we had eaten into the safety margin that had been built in to previous approvals, but we hadn't triggered or gone over the edge of that safety parameter. And so what we've done by changing the withholding period here from 1 day to 14 day is rebuild that safety buffer, which means that berries continue to be safe to eat.
That is the Chief Executive of the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, Scott Hansen, and he was speaking there to Brandon Long. You could read more about this decision and the industry's response on abc.net.au/rural.
This week on Landline, reviving a struggling country town through coffee.
I think the five of us are community-minded people, and I think you need that drive to do what we did.
That's Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
It's 3 minutes away from one. I'm tripping all over my words and everyone's names today. So thankfully the last order of business we need to get through is get the Mount Compass markets. And I'm not going to do that for you. Brooke Neindorf has those numbers. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Selena. Numbers reduced marginally as agents offered 605 live weight and open auction cattle. Quality improved this week with more C3 cattle on offer. The majority of the yarding comprised 307 cows, 124 heifers and 152 steers. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, along with feeders and restockers, providing steady competition. A feature were two drafts of Red Angus Charolais cross steers and heifers. The 14 steers at 496 kilos returned 483 cents and $2,396, with the 13 heifers at 424 kilos selling at 410 cents a kilo and $1,960 a head. A draft of Black Baldy manufacturing steers weighed in at just over a ton and returned $2.84 a head, with a line of Angus cows of similar weight selling at 410 cents a kilo to return $4,308 a head. Vela steers sold from 440 to 490 cents, with heifers selling to 417 cents a kilo. Yearling steers sold from 400 to 500 cents, or 15 to 20 cents a kilo dearer, as heifers sold up to 30 cents a kilo dearer, returning 420 to 480 cents a kilo. Manufacturing steers sold from 271 to 441 cents a kilo, and grown steers sold 10 to 15 cents a kilo dearer, as beef feeds sold from 420 to 496 cents, with dairy breeds fetching 380 to 410 cents a kilo. Grain heifers eased up to 30 cents as they sold from 390 to 457 cents a kilo. Medium beef cows sold from 340 to 411 cents, with dairy breeds fetching 220 to 300 cents a kilo and up to 15 cents a kilo dearer. Heavy beef cows sold from 350 to 440 cents, as dairy breeds range from 270 to 380 cents a kilo to be 10 cents a kilo easier. Bulls sold from 389 to 431 cents a kilo. And these numbers numbers have been provided by John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Brooke. We got it all in. That's it for me for today. Selena Green, I'll be back tomorrow at noon and we'll bring you more Country Hour then. In the meantime, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or just for search for South Australian Country Hour. In your search engine, you'll find all our episodes there as a podcast. And don't forget to head to abc.net.au/rural for some great further reading. That's it. It's time for the 1 o'clock news. I'll catch you tomorrow.
For many, the cost of living and financial hardship is taking its toll. ABC Radio is supporting disadvantaged and vulnerable people across Australia with ABC Gives. Donate now at abc.net.au/gives.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.